couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio, and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about the new films, The Broken Hearts Gallery, Rent-A-Pal, and the TV series Woke and Raised by Wolves. I'm also going to be talking about news, the box office. Yes, the box office is going to be talked about this week. I'm also going to be talking about the trailer park and the home cinema roundup featuring classic 80s horror movies, Sorority House Massacre, and Chud. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
The Academy, which does the Oscars, has announced they have some new inclusion requirements for Best Picture consideration. And like anything that's somewhat complex, when it hit the internet, everybody read the headline or about a paragraph and then suddenly started commenting about everything that they don't know anything about. The Academy of Motion Pictures Arts and Sciences said that they're starting this initiative, which begins in 2025, and it's going to be starting for pictures that are made in 2024. So we're talking 4 years down the line already. They're putting in standards for inclusion, and by inclusion, you're talking about minorities of various types, either racial minorities, and you can also have things involving women or LGBTQ plus people, and even people with disabilities. Any minority, anything is an underrepresented group of people. And the reason for this is because a good amount of productions are a lot of white people. And this has been pointed out time and time again, that even when you have a diverse movie with a cast that's diverse because you need to, you usually have a lot of people populating the production as white men and some women, but generally it tends to be pretty heavy on white men. And anyone who's worked on a film set knows that. So this is an attempt to become more diverse. And they've been trying to do this for a while. They brought in more minorities into the voting block for the Academy. And again, remember, this is just for Best Picture consideration. So what they did is they put together these four standards. And the four standards are basically segments of the production. And to be eligible for a Best Picture nomination, you have to hit two of the four standards. And basically, you have to have the right percentage of minorities in two out of four of these elements. And the first one is basically on-screen representation, which is the cast and the lead and supporting actors. Then the next one's the creative leadership, which is all the executives and the department heads, you know, somebody like the cinematographer and the composer, people in charge of costume design or production design, basically the people who make the movie happen from a crew perspective. The third standard is industry access and opportunities. And that's basically any sort of quote unquote learning gig, you know, internships and apprenticeships. And then the fourth standard is audience development, which is basically the back end of it. The marketing, the publicity, distribution, people who are involved with making the film available after the film is made. You have to reach two of those standards. And people lost their absolute minds over this. And everybody's out there on message boards saying, what are they dictating? What can be put on screen? Oh my gosh, what is this? This is like Stalin telling people what they can do. Okay, pump the brakes on this one. First of all, you only have to meet two out of four standards. So it's not at all dictating what has to be on screen. It's not saying that you have to have a diverse cast at all. You want to remake 1776, the musical, and not do a Hamilton-type cast? Yeah, you absolutely can. If you want to remake My Dinner with Andre with two white guys across the table from talking to each other, you absolutely can. It's just that the other two of three standards that are left have to be met. And one of that's publicity. And look, that comes in like far after the film is made. You know, a lot of those departments are already diverse. I deal with that department all the time, publicity and marketing. And I see people of color and women and all these different minorities involved in that. So that's not hard to meet that standard. And the other one is like, if you want to talk about production heads and that sort of thing, I mean, look, like people like, oh, you're telling people who you can hire. Well, yeah, I guess kind of in a way. And they're not even saying who you can. This isn't Stalin-esque, because it's not the government saying you have to do it. It's the Academy, and the Academy's not saying you have to do it to make a movie. They're just saying you have to do it in order to get a Best Picture nomination. So if Adam Sandler wants to go out there and make a crappy movie, he can ignore those standards all he wants to, because I don't think any of his movies are going to be getting a Best Picture nomination. Look, the people who are out there saying you should have the best unpaid or paid interns you can. If you think that there's this hiring process in Hollywood where they look at all these resumes and they pick the absolute most qualified candidate for this, you're absolutely ignorant. That's not how the business works. Hollywood is one of the most nepotism-saturated markets out there. It is about who you know, not what you know. And especially if you're getting like an internship or one of those learning opportunities, those are always somebody's nephew or friend or cousin or something like that. I have seen that in practice. And most people who've actually worked in the industry would agree with me on that. The point is, this is not some draconian thing coming after people. This is just an attempt to fix the non-inclusive nature of Hollywood as it has been for the better part of a century. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. First one I want to hit is the big one everyone was all excited to see the trailer for, and that was Dune, which hits theaters sometime in the future.
There's a crusade coming.
You inherit too much power.
My father rules an entire planet.
He's losing it. Arrakis is a death trap.
I'll kill him.
This is an extermination.
They're picking my family off one by one.
Let's fight like demons.
I am an unabashed huge fan of David Lynch's version of Dune. I read the book like I must have been in middle school. It would have been around 1984 when that movie came out, is when I read the first Dune. I never read the rest of them, but I liked Dune. I thought Dune was fascinating. And even for my young, immature mind at the time, I was fascinated by it. So I'm looking forward to this one because I also think Denis Villeneuve is a master filmmaker. I loved what he did with Blade Runner and some of his other films. The Arrival's my least favorite of the ones I've seen. I know everyone goes gaga over that, but that's not my favorite. But I think he's a great filmmaker. I'm not quite sold on Timothée Chalamet. I don't think he's that... I mean, he can act, but otherwise, in this trailer, he just stands there, does nothing. But I'm looking... The cast looks really good. The sandworm looks cool. I'm looking forward to seeing this movie. And it is something that needs to be on the big screen. So this one's certainly on my radar, even if it's not necessarily placed yet in the release schedule in stone. The next one I want to hit really quickly is Hubie Halloween, which is a Netflix original on October 7th.
Is he a good guy?
Hubie Dubois is the nicest guy in this town.
It's pretty impressive how long he's been a loser.
There's something off in this town.
Wait, you're angry?
We got an unsolved mystery here.
Dope.
Hubie! And yo, who did this?
Not now, Hubie.
I suggest we cancel Halloween immediately.
Speaking of Adam Sandler making crappy movies, look, I think some of Adam Sandler's movies aren't bad. I mean, some of them are terrible. But honestly, I think his stuff he does for Netflix is better than the stuff he put out there in theaters, because it's stuff like Jack and Jill and Grown Ups tried too hard. And this one looks like it might be funny. My biggest problem is it'd be sort of like if you finally get your prom date and you go with the homecoming queen, head cheerleader, and she's gorgeous. You're in your back seat of your car and you're making out, and she starts talking in a Cockney British accent. Hello, governor. You ready to get it on? And you're going to be like, look, everything here is great except the voice. This stupid voice that Adam Sandler does in movies like Waterboy or Little Nicky. Anyways, that's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about the Broken Hearts Gallery and Raised by Wolves.
Don't go breaking my heart.
Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump into the movie reviews and talk about the Broken Hearts Gallery. An art gallery worker in New York creates an exhibit of mementos from past relationships and becomes an overnight sensation.
You can't have a good relationship because you're constantly mourning the old one. You keep something from every relationship.
At least get rid of the ex memorabilia. Do you see this tie? It's the only thing I have left from my last relationship.
Why don't you leave it here?
A nail, perfectly placed. So look at that.
It's like art in a gallery.
Can I come in?
How did you get in here?
Your roommates. I want to show you something.
This map was here this morning?
Yep.
This is amazing. There are broken people out there like me. People who need to let go and move on.
This was one of those movies that, like so many movies over the recent few months, has been delayed. I think it was originally supposed to come out in June, and then it got pushed around the schedule, and finally it's going to theaters, and it's actually getting a theatrical release. It's exclusively in theaters, and I think they're hoping for a little bit of tidal wave from Tenet going, but we'll talk about that in the box office segment. Ultimately, this completely covers a different demographic, and it goes for the romantic comedy one. And I guess it just kind of begs the question, is it a girls' night out movie or a date movie, and do they really want to go to the theaters for this? So we'll see eventually. I mean, this is an untested genre. We've done the action film, we've done the thriller, we've done the big blockbuster, but will this bring dates out to the movies? I think everything is brand new right now. Now, the star of this is Geraldine Viswanathan, and she's shown up in a couple things, probably best known for Blockers. She was the main character in that. She kind of lit up with that one. That one was kind of gave her a bit of a breakthrough. And, you know, she's a little bit awkward. And that's, I think, what kind of makes it work. Because when you do a romantic comedy, you can't have somebody who's too secure with themselves. You kind of have to have the adorable character. That's what works in a romantic comedy. And I think she works in this one. I think she's very funny. One of the things I like about this over a movie like Blockers, which was, I'm only comparing it because she was in it. But one of the things that happens is there is this big push today, especially with Hollywood movies, this almost aggressive sex positive push for female comedies. And I'm like, sure, fine, whatever, but the main character of a romantic comedy has to gravitate towards some sort of monogamistic love relationship. And everyone says, oh, well, the guys all sleep around. I'm like, well, usually in a romantic comedy, it's like maybe the guy used to him, but he's trying to settle down, or he's got a friend who does it. And they have these gender-swapped roles of her best friends that are, well, one of them's in a relationship, another one is sleeping with anyone she can. But ultimately, it follows the standard trajectory of a romantic comedy. And in that sense, it's cute. I mean, it works. I mean, the guy's role is pretty vapid, but that's not unheard of in romantic comedies. Usually romantic comedies are one character or the other. It's either the man's journey or the woman's journey. You know, for example, My Best Friend's Wedding is Julia Roberts' story. Whereas a movie like, what was that one with Ben Affleck and Sandra Bullock? Horses of Nature back in the 90s. That one is actually Ben Affleck's role. Or that one with Ben Stiller and Jennifer Aniston back in the mid-90s, Along Came Polly. That, the story belonged to Ben Stiller's character, which a lot of other ones like, you know, Sweet Home Alabama's, Reese Witherspoon's. Usually, it's one of the romance ends, and then the other one's just sort of this attainable thing that they're trying to do. And it goes back and forth. Now, a really good romantic comedy, a really well-constructed one, something like Pretty Woman, where it's kind of both of their stories. There's growth in both Julia Roberts and Richard Gere in that film. Well, you know, or something like When Harry Met Sally, although I would argue that When Harry Met Sally is Billy Crystal's movie more than it is Meg Ryan's movie. But still, that's the standard formula. And it works. It's cute. It has that bohemian running around New York in your 20s feel to it. So I think it absolutely aims for the right demographic. And yeah, it's like, I got that sex positive message, but it's not so in your face that it's almost alarming and at times a little unsavory. And Geraldine Viswanathan, she is what holds this movie together. She does a great job. The guy who plays her love interest, he looks like the low rent version of Zac Efron before it gets built up and jacked up. But overall, it's cute. I liked it, but it's a 100% formulaic. And to the point, there's even like a joke at the end that makes fun of the formula elements of a romantic comedy. So I kind of liked it. I'm going to say it kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Raised by Wolves. This is on HBO Max. In the future, religious wars bring an end to civilization on Earth while a pair of androids are sent to a distant planet to raise human children.
Initiating trimester one.
These children are the future of humanity. You will raise these children to be atheists.
It was belief in the unreal that destroyed the Earth.
We must rescue our stolen children.
Do not tell them what I am.
This is, at least the first couple episodes are directed by Ridley Scott. I think it's 8 episodes long. I think there's 4 episodes now. Last week they released 3, which is not uncommon for, especially for a movie that needs to get some traction and world building, that they'll release 3 and then do the rest on a weekly basis. Ridley Scott's behind this, and it absolutely shows, because even though they say, oh, from the director of The Martian and Alien, it's really Prometheus that this reminds me of. And it's almost like he had these ideas, and he didn't completely create this on his own, but he certainly frames the movie, certainly the first episode, and then it spills over in the next ones. It feels like Prometheus, in the sense that Prometheus was playing around with issues with the android, which was played by Michael Fassbender. Is there life? Is there consciousness? Is there a soul? What does an android do for on its free time, on its spare time? How does it occupy itself, and what is its purpose, and what are its goals, and how does it develop, and how can it be corrupted? All those things are in Prometheus, and then they're like, oh crap, we got to deal with the aliens, where they came from. And then the movie gets distracted by all that. And I still like Prometheus quite a bit. But what this does is this says, okay, we're not going to have to worry about telling the story of the origin of the xenomorph aliens. We're telling the story of these androids trying to raise these children. And it certainly puts the religious stuff in your face. It's almost like this merging between Prometheus and Kingdom of Heaven, which was Ridley Scott's Crusades film. Because there's holy wars going on Earth, but with modern technology, and there are these androids who are absolutely atheistic, almost zealots as atheists. And they're raising the kids, but then, of course, the religious groups then try and come back and get their kids. And it's a fascinating look at religion and superstition and tradition and breaking those roles and protecting yourself and being a parent and all these elements. There's so much in there. It's very, very dense. It also has some very shocking things, and it's exciting and it's visionary. I have to say, I really, really enjoyed Raised by Wolves. It's going to turn some people off. Like, you just got to realize it treats atheism as another worldview, and you can make your own decisions, and it's going to trigger some people who, and I'd suggest don't watch it then. But it's a fascinating look at human development and anthropology, even if you're also looking at artificial humans in it. So I'm going to have to say Raised by Wolves is fascinating. At least the first 3 episodes are. I'm really anxious to watch some more. It totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Woke and Rent-A-Pal. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the movie reviews. Well, actually, with the TV reviews. We are in a renaissance for TV right now, because it started maybe 15 years ago, and it's really going and diversifying and getting rich in development, not just because you went from quality shows on broadcast, but then you went to cable shows, and now you got streaming, and they have a lot of restrictions lifted from them. So you get some really interesting stuff. So the one I want to talk about now dropped earlier this week, the whole first season, which are 8 episodes of, and that is Woke. On the brink of breaking into fame with his comic strip, cartoonist Keith Knight's attention is brought to racial issues in society, putting his career in jeopardy.
You're on your way to the top. Newspapers, TV show, movie deal.
Oh, boy. What's really going on, bro?
Earlier, I got beat by the police.
Now, I'm seeing
they are you.
Houston, we have a problem.
Man, you woke.
It's pop bottles, make cupcakes.
Did you guys lighten my photo? I look like Sammy Sosa. Am I too black for my own comic strip?
No, trust me. No one's going to ever accuse you of being too black.
I'm sorry, what?
Actually, Keith Knight is an actual cartoonist in real life, and he does the K Chronicles, which I believe is an online cartoon, and it's a woke cartoon. You know, it deals with racial issues and that sort of thing. So there's some autobiographical stuff that goes on in this. The series stars Lamorne Morris, who most people will recognize from New Girl. He was one of the roommates, one of Jessica Day's roommates in New Girl. And he plays Keith Knight, which is, you know, sort of a fictionalized version of this actual guy. And the whole purpose is he's got this very milk and toast kind of comic strip that isn't racially charged. It's not woke. It doesn't deal with social issues. It's just silly and fun and lighthearted. And then in the TV series, he gets mistaken for a suspect by cops, and he feels he's been unfairly brutalized. And then that stems from that. He starts to hallucinate. His art tools start talking to him, and, you know, trash cans start talking to him, and books and stuff like that. So it's him going a little bit crazy as well. But I gotta say, this is funny because right now you can't escape racial issues today. You turn on the radio, you turn on the TV, it's everywhere. It is everywhere. And you're hearing protests and violence and people pointing fingers at each other and yelling and screaming and tiki torches and all this kind of nonsense going on. And it can get a little bit exhausting. Let's face it, this racial discussion of today can be exhausting. And I remember when I reviewed Watchmen a couple weeks ago or a couple months ago, that's a great series, but it is exhausting to watch because it's dealing with real human issues and real violence and real death. Even though it's a fictionalized version of it, this kind of stuff, it's there in our society and you can't ignore it. One of the things that woke does is, even as aggressive of the name, because it's going to trigger people, and to the point that literally in the opening sequence, the title sequence, it's showing how people can be triggered and fragile and, you know, brittle. And so it's going to trigger people because they're going to don't want to be preached at. And I'm not saying that it doesn't have a point of view. It absolutely has a point of view, but it does it in a very humorous way so that it doesn't feel as finger pointy. It doesn't feel as aggressive, and it has some fun with it. And that's actually the best way to do it because, I mean, let's face it. Take something like Do the Right Thing. There are a lot of white people who wanted to see Do the Right Thing back in 1989 when it came out because they thought they were woke. But then there are a lot of people who didn't even want to see it because they're just like, that movie, I just don't want to deal with all the stuff that, and it's just, it's something that they didn't necessarily go to. So it didn't win anybody over. One of the things with woke is it's funny and it brings up some of the real hard issues of today, but it does it in a somewhat whimsical way. And it presents them in a very safe environment that, you know, for lack of a better term, there's a lot of white people that will take to this much more than they will if there's somebody screaming and yelling at them, or if it's this heavy documentary. This is something that you can get to know the characters and look at a little bit of nuance. And yeah, it gets a little bit pretentious at times because it does deal with the art world because he's an artist, even though he's a cartoonist, and they deal with galleries and people in the art world. And once it starts getting into that level, like about 2/3 of the way through the season, that starts to go off the rails. It needs to go focus back on basically this guy's awakening to real things that do happen. And look, I'm not making some big stance. I'm just saying it's worth checking out. It's a funny show. And if it makes you think about things that are more than what's going on in your own living room, that's a good thing. You know, I'm always for promoting understanding. And I think woke does it in probably the best way possible. So I'm going to have to say woke totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the next film, which is Rent a Pal. A lonely man who takes care of his ailing mother tries video dating and ends up finding a VHS tape with a friendly guy who promises to be his best friend.
Hi, I'm David. I'm 40 years young, and I live with my mother.
Good night, Mom.
I'm looking for a deep connection. Someone I can give myself to. Completely.
Hi, I'm Andy. Thanks for being here today. True friendship. We're gonna get to know each other.
Friendship.
Talk about whatever you want. What do you say?
That's weird, Andy.
This is a throwback 80s thriller. So it takes place in the 80s and it has all the trappings of the 80s, answering machines and VHS tapes and roller skates and bad glasses and acid wash jeans, all that stuff that you get from the 80s that somebody like me who lived through it, well, that's pretty accurate. It also shows, and my apologies to anybody who's done video data, and I'm not making fun of it, because I think that's an absolutely legitimate way to meet somebody. I know people who've actually met people through either video dating or remote dating and maybe computerized dating as, you know, once the internet took over. But this is before the days of Tinder. This is before the days of hookups. See, video dating went from the services to something like eHarmony, which matched people to an app where you can just find somebody to get a booty call. This is way before that. And this is for lonely hearts. I mean, this is that kind of thing. But it also shows just an awkward, really, I mean, fiercely awkward guy. This guy is strange. And not just because he's 40 and lives with his mother. I mean, yeah, he's taking care of her because that's what a good son does. And it does show the pressures of being a caregiver. I know I talked about taking care of my father for the past several years before he passed away this summer. And that can be exhausting. It can be a lot of work. And it's something that you do because that's what you do for your parents. But one of the things this movie, there's a section in there where he's talking to this woman he met on one of the video dates, and she is a caregiver, and she's like, look, it puts your life on hold, and it's difficult. And she starts to basically say, and it kind of touched me because I'd been through a lot of, I'm married and I have kids, so I'm not like dating in the process, but I know what it's like to put your life on hold in a lot of ways to help take care of an ailing loved one. So there's a lot of truth that's in here, but also it shows sort of the ugly side of that as well. But the real interesting part of this, the thing that makes it a horror movie, is this guy's like right on the edge. He's not insane, but it's not a very long drive to drive him crazy. You know, you're waiting for him at any moment to go full on Travis Bickle in this movie. And you know, that's going to happen because as he's got this videotape, and it's Will Wheaton who plays the guy on the videotape. And what he does is he basically just provides half of a conversation. And then this guy learns what the tape says and he learns to have conversations with the tape. So it feels like he's got a friend. And you can see him losing his mind over this. And it really has a lot to say about the comfort of fantasy over reality and how much harder it is to deal with people in real life and how much easier it is to deal with something in your own fantasy and how that sometimes can make it hard for you to break off and face reality. I enjoyed it. And I will say this, Will Wheaton, I don't know if he listens to the show, but in case he does, Will Wheaton, the address is on the website. You want to send me a VHS tape of you and we'll become friends from a one-sided conversation? Go ahead. I would be thrilled with that. So, but I'm going to have to say that Rent-A-Pal kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
That's it for the segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about the box office and the Home Cinema Roundup featuring spotlights on Chud and Sorority House Massacre. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump into the box office. This is the one that's supposed to regenerate the box office. And spoiler alert, Tenet wasn't the panacea that everybody expected it to be. And I predicted, a lot of people predicted this. Tenet did top the box office with just over $20 million for the weekend, which I believe is the full weekend, which includes Labor Day. Now, if you look at that in comparison to other Labor Days, that's not a bad opening for a movie on Labor Day weekend. Labor Day is usually a terrible time to open movies. People are trying to get their last-ditch efforts to do summertime stuff before they're completely ensconced in school. So it's not like Memorial Day or the 4th of July. It is not a movie holiday. It never has been. But there's no comparable releases to this because none of the movies in 100 years have had to deal with a pandemic. And, you know, you can't compare it to box office before there was sound in cinema. So people have been struggling to figure out, is this a good number? Because you got to remember that New York and LA and San Francisco, none of those theaters were open. So at least the brick and mortar theaters, the drive-ins were open. So when you look at that 20 million, you're like, well, that's not bad in a pandemic. But here's the problem. Here's why that number's not that good. Normally a non-Batman Christopher Nolan movie makes 50 million or more opening weekend. And I would never expected that much, but 20 million, that's still low. And I'll tell you why. First of all, it has the Canadian numbers in there. And Canada's not known for massive box office numbers, but their theaters are open. And they don't have the oppressive number of coronavirus and worries about spreads that we do. So already you got to carve some of that and say, well, that belongs to Canada. So it's even smaller than 20 million. And on top of it, even though it was in limited capacity, you know, some of these theaters are as low as 20 or 30% capacity is what they could fill. Like the theaters around me, it was in like 8 houses in the theater. So it was like having it in at least 2 houses normally. So that should have balanced some of the low attendance. Also, here's the other thing with Christopher Nolan movies. They tend to leg out. They do well and they don't drop much. And that's what we're going to be looking at this weekend and next weekend to see how much it drops. Did this actually recharge the box office? Or are you going to see a plummet of 70-some percent like you did with Onward back in March? And if that's the case, then it's a flop for Tenet. And that's understandable in conditions. But what that means is maybe people aren't ready to go to blockbusters yet. And there's a reason why Warner Brothers is getting ready to waffle about Wonder Woman. Because if they release that at the beginning of October, they're in direct competition with Tenet, which is their own movie. And they don't know if they're going to make enough money for that. And there's a reason why when the Dune trailer came out, there's no release date on it. Because they may just scrap that completely out of the holiday frame and throw it into 2021. So there's still a lot of things that are up in the air. Tenet did not change everything. And, you know, that's to be expected. That was a huge thing to put on Tenet's shoulders, and it was never going to work. So, yeah, I really don't think that 20 million is that good of a number. Also, if you notice, Warner Brothers isn't releasing daily numbers this week at all. If they were making $10 million a day, they would brag about it, but they're not. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. Today's spotlights are on older films because there are some movies still coming out on DVD and Blu-ray, but we've pretty much burned through a lot of theatrical releases. I mean, I'm going to start dipping into those older ones. And of course, I've declared it Halloween time. It's September, but that's okay. It's good enough for me. So I'm watching some horror movies. And one of the services I've been watching a little bit lately is Tubi TV. I talked about this at the beginning of the pandemic. Tubi TV is a free service. And what I love about Tubi is they got obscure stuff. You want weird movies that you can't find anywhere else, a lot of times you can find them on Tubi. And the first one I want to talk about is this weird little movie that has some strange remembrances in the world today, and that is Chud. A photographer, a detective, and a guy who runs a soup kitchen join forces to battle mutant creatures in the sewers of New York City.
Beneath the city of New York are living catacombs, an endless maze of subterranean tunnels. Unfit for anything human.
Hold it! They start moving up ahead in the tunnel!
They're coming up. Chud. Cannibalistic, humanoid, underground dwellers.
Chud came out in the early 80s, and I remember when it came out. I remember the posters. I remember the ads on TV, and I wanted to see it so bad, but I was too young. My parents won't let me see it because it's R. And it got remembered in weird ways. One of the things that happened is a website started called Chud, which kept the name out there. And there was the movie Us, the Jordan Peele movie, at the beginning. The kids watching a Hands Across America thing, and there's a Chud videotape up there. So it has this weird cult status. The other thing is one of those movies that kind of got lost for a while because no one could figure out who owned the rights because different companies sold it off here and there. Chud is a god-awfully terrible movie. It is one of the dirtiest movies I've ever seen. And I'm not talking about like sexually dirty. I'm just talking about grimy. Every scene in this movie looks like somebody burnt grease in the kitchen right before they started filming. It looks sleazy and slimy. I mean, Daniel Stern plays the guy from the soup kitchen. I don't think he took a bath through the entire production, and that was part of his role. And he's got sweat stains on his pits and stuff like that. Oh, it's the filthiest looking movie, and it's kind of terrible for like the first 80%. Because it's just them trying to track down these attacks that happened in the sewer, and they're loosely associating characters with each other. But like that last 20% is amazing. It is full on over the top action for a horror movie with these monsters that are humanoid and they're getting blown up and explosions happening, and it's violent and there's gore. And so it's like, it's one of those movies. And there's a lot of these movies I've noticed from particularly the 80s, maybe even into the 90s, where they're kind of boring for the first chunk of it, but boy, they got such a great ending. So I'm going to have to say Chud is a hoot to watch, but yeah, it is violent and gory, but honestly, you can't take this movie seriously. I'm going to say it kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Sorority House Massacre really quickly. A would-be sorority pledge spends a weekend in a house only to be stalked by a killer from her past.
After a weekend with us, you're going to want to join this sorority. Maybe we are the haunted sorority house after all.
Am I crazy?
Oh, God. It's him.
That's him. That's the guy from my dream.
But where's not his family? I think I am.
Sorority House Massacre. A slash course in absolute terror.
Earlier this month, I announced on Facebook and Twitter that I'm going to be doing horror movies, and I asked people for suggestions. And if you have other suggestions, go ahead and email me, send me a DM or an at reply on Twitter, or send something on my Facebook page. And somebody I went to high school with suggested Sorority House Massacre. She's like, oh, I haven't seen it. I remember being so scared by it when I was, you know, a teenager. Cause, you know, we were both teenagers when this thing came out, about 15 or 16. And apparently this is in the series of massacre movies from New Concord, which was Roger Corman's movie. And he did Slumber Party Massacre. And I think there were three of those. And then he did Sorority House Massacre. And there's a second one. This one's really low rent. It's also a huge ripoff of Halloween and in a way Prom Night, but it's every cliche of a horror movie. And, you know, you watch the trailer with its goofy Scooby-Doo sound effects. And I gotta say, the trailer's more exciting than the movie. I will say this, though, at least it delivers in terms of what you expect from an 80s slashers. There's nudity, and there's violence, and there's gore, and there's stupidity, and bad fashion. The other thing that's funny about this movie is my sister was in a sorority. So I go over to the sorority house all the time, and she had friends, and I'd go over there. I never, like, dated anyone from a sorority, but I'd spent plenty of time in sorority houses just because I had access through my sister. This is not what sorority houses look like or act like. I don't know who advised them on their Greek system here, but it just looks ridiculous. The movie's, honestly, though, the movie's not that good. It struggles to find a plot, and it struggles to explain why characters exist. It's got a great poster. It's got a great title. But honestly, I wish there was as much massacring going on in the movie as there was in the trailer, because it has some problems. So I'm going to have to say Sorority House Massacre kind of sucks. But you can get them both on Tubi now if you want to watch them.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
Also available on DVD and Blu-ray include First Cow, Supergirl, the complete fifth season, Ghost in the Shell in 4K, the original animated film, and the Alfred Hitchcock collection featuring Rear Window, Vertigo, Psycho, and The Birds all in 4K. And that's it for this week. I need to go. When I come back next week, I'm going to be talking about Antebellum, The Devil All the Time, and All in the Fight for Democracy. Until then, have a fat time at the movies or at home.